All right, today's show, October 7th, 2009. A brief squib out of American Free Press. Despite the global economic collapse, the U.S. military industrial banking complex has actually increased its share to more than two-thirds of total global weapons sales. And this is reported in a new congressional study. The weapons makers brought in some $40 billion last year, or 68% of all business in global bomb making. That's significantly up from total sales from 2007. So if you're looking for a surefire investment opportunity, invest in the U.S. weapons industry. No matter what happens to the rest of the economy, those boys do real well. This one was out of the Chronicle, Associated Press article. Low oil prices may cut Iraq's military funds. Iraq's budget shortfall due to low oil prices presents a challenge to building up the country's army and raises questions about whether it will be able to protect itself when U.S. troops leave. This was said by a top American commander. Iraq's security plans have been derailed because of a drop in oil prices, hampering efforts to buy ships. Did you hear that? Ships. What the hell does the Iraq army need with ships? End of article. Trying to squeeze more money. This one blew my mind. This is out of the New York Times. The headline, Panel Easing Penalties for Those Without Insurance. The Senate Finance Committee moved Thursday to soften the impact of financial penalties that would be imposed on people who did not obtain insurance under the sweeping health care legislation. The lawmakers said they would delay and reduce the penalties for others. What in hell is going on here? This is supposed to be health care reform, and now they're going to penalize us if we don't have mandatory health insurance? The whole thing as proposed, remember, these are simply proposals. They haven't actually come up for a vote yet. But the proposal includes mandatory, this is in the Senate, includes mandatory health insurance. The Senate is not including a public option. And now they've got the gall to be imposing penalties on those without insurance. What a reform. Some of the representatives are against this, including Olympia Stowe, who's a Republican. And you have to wonder at this point, since the Republicans are opposing this thing and the Democrats are for it, who's the party of the people at this point? I mean, this is absurd. I'm not going to read the article. You got the gist of it. All right, this just in from the Somali pirates. Oops, I guess we kind of blew it that time. All right, my commentary for today, October 7th. I seldom do movie reviews, but Michael Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story, is more than a movie. It's a political statement on film. So here goes. I found it entertaining in parts, slow and boring at times. Michael's heart is in the right place, and I love him for it, but I really think he needs a content editor. For example, he devotes far too much time to the plight of airline pilots' low pay. Most American professions are paid too little, while some professions, notably doctors and the legal boys, are paid far too much. Oh, some are paid far too much. CEOs, doctors, and lawyers come to mind, but I'm sure you can think of others. Another area I thought Moore devoted far too much footage to was the very emotional examples he showed of people losing their homes to foreclosure. We all know that's happening. What we don't know is the circumstances of the loans that those folks defaulted on. Do they bear some responsibility for signing risky loans? We don't know. The most egregious waste of film was the issue of companies taking out life insurance policies on their employees. Maybe I'm missing something, but I can't find anyone harmed by this practice. Unless the companies then arrange for their insured employees' death in order to collect, perhaps by giving them more dangerous jobs, it's simply gambling by the companies, and who cares? If they want to toss money at insurance companies, who's harmed? And I'm mystified why the families of the dead employees are upset. What prevented them from taking out similar life insurance policies? To me, that was a complete waste of film. So I feel Moore wasted a lot of time, film, and energy on non-issues. On this last point, even the grumpy old moose agreed with me. That might be a first. However, the film for me was saved by his reminding us of the devastation of unions under the Reagan era, the privatization of public functions, the widening gap between the richest and the rest, the financial collapse of late 2008, the criminal absurdity of Goldman Sachs effectively running our Treasury Department, and that $700 billion government bailout. His scenes toward the ends of the film of backing an armored truck up to various corporate headquarters and demanding reimbursement of taxpayer dollars, and then his wrapping crime scene tape around the New York Stock Exchange, those were hilarious and more at his finest. There is a story floating around that didn't make the film, and that is, supposedly, reportedly, that when Moore was out there wrapping the crime scene tape around the stock exchange, a police officer approached him, and Moore immediately told him, "Hey, don't worry, we're only going to take a couple of minutes to shoot this film. It'll only be a few minutes." And the cop reportedly said to him, "Listen, these guys cost us half of our pensions. Take as long as you like." Okay, hopefully with all the attendant publicity, and since this film is being presented in mainstream movie theaters, a broader scope of Americans will awaken to the fraud being perpetrated upon them. If Moore succeeds in awakening at least some slumbering Americans, he and his film will be perhaps one of the most important films of our generation. We shall see. And there was an article on the web that there was a theater in the South that I guess they were booked to show the film, so they showed it, but they didn't advertise it. They advertised all the other films they were showing, but they didn't advertise that one. And when some newspaper phoned them and asked them why, they said, "Well, we're experimenting with a new advertising policy." And that policy, obviously, is not to advertise films. Next item. San Francisco Chronicle had an article on the latest debunking of the Shroud of Turin. I enjoyed this comment that followed the article. Oh, the Shroud of Turin, in case anybody doesn't know, that's been a long cloth that supposedly Christ's body was wrapped in this cloth and it bears after his death, and it bears some signs of that, and there's been controversy over whether the cloth is real or not. So I enjoyed this comment in the Chronicle. "You know, if you really think about it, isn't it about time God said something? Anything would do. How you all doing? Or stop doing that right now. Anything. Strikes me as it's been awful quiet around here for about 2,000 years, and an ancient shroud with an old dead European featuring Christ is not so very convincing evidence of anything, other than man's capacity to believe anything. The more fantastic, the better." This next article is by Robert Fisk. He writes in The Independent out of the United Kingdom. And I've heard Fisk speak many times on Democracy Now! And others, and he sounds very knowledgeable. He calls it "Secret Plan to Ditch the U.S. Dollar's Dominance Uncovered." "In the most profound financial change in recent Middle Eastern history, Gulf Arabs are planning, along with China, Russia, Japan, and France, to end dollar dealings for oil, moving instead to a basket of currencies including the Japanese yen and Chinese yuan, the euro, gold, and a new unified currency planned for nations in the Gulf Cooperative Council, including Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Kuwait, and Qatar. Secret meetings have already been held by finance ministers and central bank governors in Russia, China, Japan, and Brazil to work on the scheme, which will mean that oil will no longer be priced in dollars. The plans, confirmed to The Independent by both Gulf Arab and Chinese banking sources in Hong Kong, may help to explain the sudden rise in gold prices, but it also augurs an extraordinary transition from dollar markets within 9 years. The Americans..." Let me interrupt here to remind listeners that one of the reasons why we decided to invade Kuwait, which of course had, when we decided to invade Iraq, which of course had nothing to do with 9/11, one of the reasons was Saddam Hussein was about to begin trading his oil in euros rather than dollars. Back to the article. The Americans, who are aware the meetings have taken place, although they have not discovered the details, are sure to fight this international cabal, which will include hitherto loyal allies Japan and the Gulf Arabs. Against the background of these currency meetings, Sun Bigham, China's former special envoy to the Middle East, has warned there is a risk of deepening divisions between China and the U.S. over influence and oil in the Middle East. Quote, "Bilateral quarrels and clashes are unavoidable," he told the Asia and Africa Review. "We cannot lower vigilance against hostility in the Middle East over energy interests and security." This sounds like a dangerous prediction of a future economic war between the U.S. and China over Middle East oil, yet again turning the region's conflict into a battle for great power supremacy. China uses more oil incrementally than the U.S. because its growth is less energy efficient. The transitional currency in the move away from dollars, according to Chinese banking sources, may well be gold. An indication of the huge amounts involved can be gained from the wealth of Abu Dhabi, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Qatar, who together hold an estimated $2.1 trillion in dollar reserves. Remember that a trillion is a million million. The decline of American economic power linked to the current global recession was implicitly acknowledged by the World Bank President Robert Zolnick. Quote, "One of the legacies of this crisis may be a recognition of changed economic power relations," he said in Istanbul, ahead of meeting this week of the IMF and World Bank. "But it is China's extraordinary new financial power, along with past anger amongst oil-producing and oil-consuming nations at America's power to interfere in the international financial system, which has promoted the latest discussions involving the Gulf states. Brazil has shown interest in collaborating in non-dollar oil payments, along with India. Indeed, China appears to be the most enthusiastic of all the financial powers involved, not least because of its enormous trade with the Middle East. China imports 60% of its oil, much of it from the Middle East and Russia. The Chinese have oil production concessions in Iraq, blocked by the U.S. until this year, and since 2008 have held an $8 billion agreement with Iran to develop refining capacity and gas resources. China has oil deals in Sudan, where it has substituted for U.S. interests, and has been negotiating for oil concessions with Libya, where all such contracts are joint ventures. Furthermore, Chinese exports to the region now account for no fewer than 10% of the import of every country in the Middle East, including a huge range of products from cars to weapon systems, food, clothes, even dolls. I find that figure interesting, no fewer than 10% of the import of every country. I don't know the percentage of imports in the United States that are Chinese, but I'd wager it's far greater than 10%. Every time I go to a store to buy something, it's made in China. Back to the article. In a clear sign of China's growing financial muscle, the president of the European Central Bank, Jean-Claude Trichet, yesterday pleaded with Beijing to let the yuan appreciate against a sliding dollar and, by extension, loosen China's reliance on U.S. monetary policy to help rebalance the world's economy and ease upward pressure on the euro. Ever since the Bretton Woods agreements, the accords after the Second World War, which bequeathed the architecture for the modern international financial system, America's trading partners have been left to cope with the impact of Washington's control and, in more recent years, the hegemony of the dollar as the dominant global reserve currency. I want to interrupt again to remind that it's not Washington that's controlling the dollar, it's the Federal Reserve System. And the Federal Reserve System is international in that it is owned by European as well as American banks. So it's the banksters that are responsible for this. Back to the article. The Chinese believe, for example, that the Americans persuaded Britain to stay out of the euro in order to prevent an earlier move away from the dollar. But Chinese banking sources say their discussions have gone too far to be blocked now. The Russians will eventually bring in the ruble to the basket of currencies, a prominent Hong Kong broker told The Independent. The Brits are stuck in the middle and will come into the euro. They have no choice because they won't be able to use the U.S. dollar. Chinese financial sources believe President Barack Obama is too busy fixing the U.S. economy to concentrate on the extraordinary implications of the transition from the dollar in 9 years' time. The current deadline for the currency transition is 2018. The U.S. discussed the trend briefly at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh. The Chinese central bank governor and other officials have been worrying aloud about the dollar for years. Their problem is that much of their national wealth is tied up in dollar assets. These plans will change the face of international financial transactions, one Chinese banker said. America and Britain must be very worried. You will know how worried by the thunder of denials this news will generate. Iran announced late last month that its foreign currency reserves would henceforth be held in euros rather than dollars. Bankers remember, of course, what happened to the last Middle East oil producer to sell its oil in euros rather than dollars, a few months after Saddam Hussein trumpeted his decision, the Americans and British invaded Iraq. That was Robert Fisk writing in the Independent of the United Kingdom. Okay, a couple of articles on Afghanistan. Afghanistan, The Great Pretend Game. It's by Edward Girardet, published in opednews.com. By the way, one of the reasons I'm having trouble reading today is that my printer, I put in a new laser cartridge and it's messing up, and so the print is very bad. So some of this is my mind failing over time, and some of it is it's just hard to read. Afghanistan, The Great Pretend Game by Edward Girardet, opednews.com. Edward Girardet is a former foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, the NewsHour, and other media, who has been covering Afghanistan for 30 years. He's author of Afghanistan, the Soviet War, and The Essential Field Guide to Afghanistan. He recently returned on a grant from San Francisco-based Center for Investigative Reporting. Since this is a long article and I have a call, we will take the call. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Thank you. Chumba, just an add-on to that Iran switching away to the euro from the dollar leading to their invasion. The other part, the counterpoint, or not this, the kind of the end of that story, is that Bush's famous mission accomplished speech was given as soon as Iraq had been forced back on the dollar.
Fascinating.
That's all for now.
That's all for now. Thanks for the call. All right. The article, Afghanistan, the Great Pretend Game. Afghanistan may not be lost yet, but we're skirting precariously close. The international community is blatantly out of touch with realities on the ground, while ordinary Afghans increasingly regard NATO troops as the new occupiers, not unlike the Soviets of the 80s. For many, Afghanistan is no longer theirs, but a land run by outsiders. The U.S.-led engagement following the collapse of the Talib regime in late 2001 was billed to Afghans as a commitment to help Afghanistan achieve stability and recovery. Today, however, a mixed and often futile agenda of military counterinsurgency and narcotics operations is absorbing the bulk of Western investment. At the same time, holed up in their heavily fortified compounds, the U.S. and other international missions are finding themselves increasingly cut off from both the country and its people. Incidents such as the coalition bombing in early September in Kunduz, with its high civilian casualties, have only deepened Afghan resentment. Civilians complain bitterly about the foreign troops, including mercenaries, who halt traffic at the end of a gun, fire on vehicles, or enter homes and clinics without apology. As one Afghan engineer, who originally supported the coalition, told me, "They have no manners and treat us like dogs. It's time for them to go." The growing militarization of operations in Afghanistan mean that even long-standing humanitarian activities have become suspect in the eyes of Afghans. With nearly three-quarters of the country now considered no-go zones by the United Nations, recent years have witnessed a rise in insurgent attacks against aid workers. The internationals have developed a siege mentality, partly encouraged by the private security companies benefiting from a lucrative business that now accounts for up to one-quarter of operational budgets. Most American, British, and other international mission staff are not allowed out of their heavily barricaded compounds, often for months on end. Only the chosen few can leave, and then usually only accompanied by armed guards, which hardly encourages interaction with local Afghans. Such isolation is expected to grow worse. The Americans are seeking to promote a new fusion with joint military-civilian operations as their way of persuading Afghans that they are here for their own good. For the humanitarians, this will only undermine their integrity and make it even more hazardous to work. They also fear that European donors will fall in line with Washington by making their funding contingent on collaborating with the military. During a recent visit to Afghanistan, I probed scores of Afghans, international aid workers, and mission representatives with long-time experience in the country over how to put the recovery process back on track. All stressed the deepening isolation of the international community as the main reason for the crumbling recovery effort. Some described the Western effort as completely out of control, close quote, with funds poorly spent and little effective coordination. As one seasoned British NGO coordinator maintained, the military refused to recognize how much they're hated, no matter how they dress it up, while the way aid is dispersed is disastrous. There's a lot of people in complete denial about what's being achieved, he said. International representatives, including senior NATO officers, admit that such bunkering severely compromised their ability to stay informed. As one senior advisor with U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke admitted, remaining in touch with what's happening on the outside of the sprawling U.S. Embassy compound in Kabul is their biggest problem. Experienced players warn that the corrosive lack of knowledge about Afghanistan amongst Western, quote, experts is another crippling factor. There's a lot of comment being made by people who have no idea what they're talking about, and yet are the ones in charge of shaping Western policy in Afghanistan, they maintain. For Anders Fanch, co-founder of the Swedish Committee for Afghanistan, which first began working clandestinely in Afghanistan during the early 80s, the West still has no clear strategy. Quote, no one can really explain what they're doing or what their real objective is for being here, he said. Although considerable strides have been made in health and education, uncontrolled corruption threatens even these gains. American and other foreign companies are regularly granted major contracts despite vaunting overheads and high salaries, with as little as 5% reaching Afghanistan itself. Wow. 5% actually reaching Afghanistan. Hundreds of millions of dollars vanish yearly into the pockets of corrupt Afghan officials. Transparency International now ranks Afghanistan as the fifth most corrupt country in the world, just behind Haiti. Many Afghans bitterly wonder where the over $20 billion of aid pledges have gone. They criticize the internationals for filling the bellies of the privileged elites, including the Karzai regime. Quote, international recovery has become one big pretend game. This was said by the Aga Khan Foundation architect, Jolene Leslie, who's been working here for 20 years. Mohammed Eshkak, a former Northern Alliance information director, now managing an IT company in Kabul, agrees. Many outsiders are simply ticking off the boxes for the sake of appearance. It doesn't matter if something works or not, he said. Since the intervention in October of 2001, Western donors have largely failed to heed recommendations for carefully implemented recovery initiatives, notably in rural areas, where nearly 80% of the population lives. They also ignored warnings not to throw money at Kabul, turning it into another Dubai that ensures the comfort of the international community but offers little to the rest of the country. Aid workers argue that the Taliban and other insurgents, whose support is spreading within the aid agencies and government ministries, need to be involved. They point out that working in communities with known rebel elements has not prevented them from promoting girls' education or agricultural initiatives for women. Direct engagement with local populations is precisely what the most experienced NGOs have been doing for years. Quote, working in the villages takes longer, and it's far more difficult than Kabul, but it's the only way to make changes. It's also one's best security. This was said by coordinator Pascal Arfan of Madeira, a French agricultural NGO. 8 years on, there needs to be far more informed new thinking about what to do about Afghanistan based on on-the-ground realities. The current message is that overcoming the insurgency by military-dominated means has become far more important than rebuilding the country. yet nothing has ever been achieved in Afghanistan by force. NATO's proposed new initiatives are too late. The hatred for the occupiers already exists. Many Afghans, including senior government officials, simply have no confidence in the staying power of the international community. For recovery to succeed, the West needs to make its long-term commitment clear and unequivocal. Equally crucial, it needs to reestablish contact with ordinary Afghans, particularly those who consider the insurgents the better option. That was Edward Girardet, writing in opednews.com, or at least republished by them. The time is 12:35. The place is Nevada City, California. The radio station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. The radio show is called Rabble Rousing, and your host is Chamberlain. Okay, one more article on Afghanistan. I found the following particularly moving, and more importantly, containing wise and practical suggestions for ending the war in Afghanistan. One can only hope that President Obama hears this message and its suggestions. It's called A Plea for Peace from Afghanistan. It's by Robert C. Kohler, and it was published in SmirkingChimp.com. This talk was delivered on September 25th in Bandi Amir, Afghanistan's first national park in the Hindu Kush Mountains of central Afghanistan, Bamiyan Province, in connection with the United Nations International Day of Peace. I posted here to let the great hope for peace radiate far and wide. The speech was written by a peacemaker named Hakim Tekyongwi on behalf of all the Afghan youth of our journey to smile in Bamiyan, Afghanistan. Salam alaikum. With all due honor, so this was written by a student. It doesn't give the age. He calls it Reconciliation of Civil Hearts. With all due honor to our international friends from the American, Australian, German, Dutch, and Japanese embassies, and from the UN family, Chief of Staff of UN Afghanistan Peter Schmitz, and Head of UNAMA Bamiyan Heron Song, we welcome you and the possibility of peace to this forgotten but gorgeous place. We thank you for your hearts of peace and joining with us in our journey today. We, the ordinary youth of Afghanistan, have a message for you, our guests and friends, and for Barack Obama, Gordon Brown, Angela Merkel, Nicolas Sarkozy, Kevin Rudd, Yves Leterme, Yuriko Hatoyama, Ban Ki-moon, and Ken Ide, and all the distinguished leaders of our disconnected world. We are the youth of the mountains, who do not represent any political or religious views, except for those views which make us truly human, capable of acting in love and truth, in good times as well as in tragedy. We are tired of war, and we desire peace. We have great problems indeed, but we also have courage because we have with us the great Afghan outdoors like this, and we have within us an even greater desire for creative, nonviolent solutions. We desire reconciliation. It's time to struggle for a reconciliation of civil hearts instead of fueling a clash of civilizations. We wish to converse as equal fellow human beings without the need for guns and bombs. So we plead that you'll facilitate our elders in calling for as many loyal Jirgas as is necessary to restore our recognition of and care for each other's human worth. We desire to patiently build our nation. So, while we appreciate your friendship and company, we desire just as much to trek on our own paths, build our own parks, and choose which of our own mountains to climb. We desire the dignity of working with our own hands and walking with our own legs. So we ask for a halt to proud, agenda-driven help that makes us dependent beggars. We ask for assistance that builds factories, industries, roads, and an economy that would put food in our simple but hospitable homes. We desire justice and truth. So we ask for your support in denying space to corruption, fraud, lies, and deception, and in quenching the abusive greed for power and money that are destroying our society and humanity as much as violence and war are. Many of us are suffering at the expense of a few. So though the few rich and powerful are loud and dominant, their monopoly is neither moral nor democratic. We may be suffering, but suffering eyes can still see, not with a sight that sees only appearances, but with the insight that sees beyond words to raw but real meanings. Like you, we're human beings who desire to love and be loved. Perhaps we have deeper anger, hatred, and fears than your citizens have. But we believe that man cannot overcome such giants with bloodshed. We learn to overcome them when we understand each other. So we ask for the nurturing of wide-scale, local, and international human relationships that would empathize with our shared human condition, restore trust, and tear down barriers. We need to explore human relationships and nonviolent options, like we pursue science for the sake of the original Charter of the United Nations, a part of which we'll read to remind ourselves, Ban Ki-moon and those of us working with the UN family, of our enormous generational responsibility. I quote the preamble, Charter of the United States. We, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, and for these ends, to practice tolerance and live together in peace with one another as good neighbors, have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims. Close quote. We wonder if President Obama will listen as he claims he would. You may think us silly, but we wonder if any international will ever listen to the ordinary Afghan voice in making decisions that affect 30 million of us, often fatally. We desire to have peace, as peace truly means, in the souls of men. America is the largest arms dealer in the world, and the world's superpowers have enough nuclear warheads to destroy this beautiful place, Afghanistan, and our whole earth, 10 times over. Thus, after more than a century of the great game, we have our sincere doubts about superpowers bringing us true peace. We can no longer remain silent to our conscience, as appropriate to the freedoms you enjoy in your native countries, in humbly disagreeing with the current U.S.-NATO predominantly military approach to our country's problems. In our world today, words may sound kind, but actions prove that 90% of international effort and wealth in Afghanistan is spent on war. And our history and our deaths prove again and again that no human being wins from such an approach. So we ask to be spared the disappointment and grief of such discrepancies. Your soldiers individually mean well, but we are not willing, like the majority of ordinary Americans and Europeans today, that any of them should perish, just as we're concerned that not one more of our countrymen should die a violent death. The world should not move along the unilateral one-track path of violence and militarism anymore. We cannot cope. No human can. We should work together to walk along the multiple tracks that lead us to beauty, to dreams, and to these values, virtues, and thoughtful conversations which every heart longs for. So please, we ask that the world shifts her engagement with our sovereign country to a 90% civilian approach. We should have as many civil forums, as many civil negotiations, as many civil discussions, and as many civil occasions for relationship building as are imaginatively possible. We believe that these civil efforts cannot be done through either our local military or any foreign military, because mankind cannot build relations with weapons. General McChrystal said in his report to Obama that our Afghan government is riddled with corruption. With all due respect, he seems to have ignored the fact that in our warlord country of masterful deceit and insatiable greed, our Afghan army and police, whose numbers he hopes to increase, are at least just as corrupt, if not much more. Please don't go that way. We believe that neither foreign nor local military escalation would bring victory to anyone, as that would be going towards failure, if not a military failure, then a civilizational failure of our very souls. We desire to recover those friendships captured by Khalid Hussani, the UNHCR Goodwill Ambassador, in his book, The Kite Runner, the kind of friendships in which we can say to one another and to all others, for you, 1,000 times over, Salaam Alaikum. We desire security as much as you do for your own countries. The Taliban has wreaked havoc in this valley too, and killed many of us. Our people fled from them across this very Hindu Kush mountain range. We do not accept their violent actions, just as we do not accept the violent solution the world has been counting on. We have become a terror to one another in our inconsiderate actions and in our cowardly silence, and this must stop. We hope to continue 8 and more years of security in Bamiyan by refusing violence and by refusing to take revenge. And we wish to refuse the insurgent any further excuse to hurt us because of a foreign presence. Brothers killing brothers, friends killing friends, humans killing one another. Thus, while we're grateful for your help with our safety, we desire just as much that your noble military presence would leave us responsibly and leave us at an appropriate time soon. We need to travel this history and this future on our own. You need not fear. We, the ordinary youth of Afghanistan, will ask for your help again if our paths take us to unmanageable scenarios, even in open spaces and free and as quiet as this. For then we expect nothing but what our humanity guides each of us to do to help a brother, sister, friend, or fellow human being in time of need. Despite experiencing a difficult past betrayal, Hassan, the Hazara boy and kite runner, wrote a letter to his Pushtun friend Amir, which got to Amir only after Hassan's death. In it, we find some of our hopes described. Quote, "We dream that God will guide us to a better day. We dream that our sons will grow up to be good persons. We dream that lawa, flowers and tulips, will bloom in the streets of Kabul again, and rubab music will play in the Samir houses, and kites will fly in the blue skies. And we dream that someday you will return to Afghanistan to revisit. If you do, you'll find an old faithful friend waiting for you. There's a way to be good again. From the bottom of our hearts, be courageous, be happy, and be at peace." That was speech given by Hakim Tekyongwi on behalf of all the Afghan youth. They were gathered in Bamiyan, which was the valley where the Taliban blew up those giant Buddha statues. The gathering was called Afghan Youth on Our Journey to Smile. And from that article, the one thing I gleaned most importantly is he was suggesting that the U.S. and NATO convene Loya Jirgas, gatherings of the Afghan people. Rather than imposing our way on them, why not utilize their way? They have a way of settling disputes. That's what the Loya Jirgas are about. And why don't we hear Obama talking about Loya Jirgas? Okay, where do we go from here? Well, let's switch gears a bit. I found this one interesting. Egyptian lawmakers ban a kit that helps women fake virginity. Cairo. Conservative Egyptian lawmakers have called for a ban on importing a Chinese-made kit meant to help women fake their virginity. And one scholar has even called for the exile of anyone who imports or uses it. The artificial virginity hymen kit, distributed by a Chinese company, Jijimo, costs about $30. It's intended to help newly married women fool their husbands into believing they're virgins, which is culturally important in the conservative Middle East, where sex before marriage is considered by many to be illicit. The product leaks a blood-like substance when inserted and broken. A sheikh, a member of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, who's on the Parliamentary Committee on Religious Affairs, said the kits will make it easier for Egyptian women to give in to temptation. He demanded the government takes responsibility for fighting the product to uphold Egyptian and Arab values. Quote, "It will be a mark of shame on the ruling party if it allowed this product to enter the market," he said in a notice posted on their Brotherhood's Parliament website. The Muslim Brotherhood is Egypt's largest political opposition group. Prominent Egyptian religious scholar Bayomi said anyone who imports the artificial hymen should be punished. "This product encourages illicit sexual relations. Islamic culture forbids these relations, except within the confines of marriage," he said. "I think this should absolutely not be allowed to be exported, because it brings more harm than benefits. Whoever imports it should be punished." In a country in a region where premarital sex is so taboo it can even lead to a woman's murder, The debate over the virginity faking kid has revived Egypt's constant struggle to reconcile modern Moors with more traditional beliefs, namely, that a woman is not a virgin unless she bleeds after the first time. Bleeding is the... Then there was a commentator who noted that there's a medical procedure that reattaches a broken hymen by stitching, and that's illegal in Egypt. It can cost hundreds of dollars, which is prohibitively expensive for the poor. But many women still secretly seek it out in fear of punishment for premarital sex. Such punishment could include death by stoning or slayings at the hands of relatives, a practice more commonly referred to as honor killings. I have to say that when I was in Egypt, which was back in the 60s, admittedly back in the 60s, I met many young men that said absolutely if their sister, if they found out that their sister engaged in sex before marriage, they would slay their own sister. So it was very real then. I have to assume it's still real now. The website provided instructions in English for the first-time user of the fake hymen. Insert this artificial hymen into your vagina carefully. When your lover penetrate, it will ooze out a liquid that looks like blood, not too much, but just the right amount. Add in a few moans and groans, and you'll pass through undetectable. There you have it. I think another interesting aspect of that is it really does illustrate the tremendous difference in cultures between the conservative Muslim world and the Western world. That virginity is tremendously important in marriage, before marriage. Next one's by Gordon Duff, SalemNews.com. The 9/11 Commission rejects its own report as based on government lies. The 9/11 Commission now tells us that the official version of 9/11 was based on false testimony and documents and is almost entirely untrue. The details of this massive cover-up are carefully outlined in a book by John Farmer, who was the senior counsel for the 9/11 Commission. Farmer, dean of Rutgers University School of Law and former Attorney General of New Jersey, was responsible for drafting the original 9/11 report. Does Farmer have cooperation and agreement for other members of the commission? Yes. Did they say Bush ordered 9/11? No. Did they say that the 9/11 commission was lied to by the FBI, CIA, White House, and NORAD? Yes. Is there full documentary proof of this? Yes. Farmer states, at some level of the government, at some point in time, there was an agreement not to tell the truth about what happened. I was shocked at how different the truth was from the way it was described. The NORAD air defense tapes told a radically different story from what has been told to us and the public for 2 years. This is not spin. The 9/11 Commission head, Thomas Keene, was the Republican governor of New Jersey. He had the following to say, quote, "We, to this day, don't know why NORAD, the North American Aerospace Command, told us what they told us. It was just so far from the truth." Close quote. When Bush's own hand-picked commission failed to go along with the cover-up and requested a criminal investigation, why was nothing done? 9/11 Commission member and former U.S. Senator Bob Kerry says, "No one is more qualified to write the definitive book about the tragedy of 9/11 than John Farmer. Fortunately, he's done so. Even more fortunately, the language is clear, alive, and instructive for anyone who wants to make certain this never happens again." Close quote. I'm going to continue reading this article, but this whole thing blows my mind. Why are these guys waiting years to come out with this? And why did they allow their commission report to be published in the first place when they knew it was utter BS? I don't get it. Back to the article. With the only official 9/11 report now totally false, where do we go from here? Who's hurt by these lies? The families of the victims of 9/11 have fought for years to get to the truth. For years, our government has hidden behind lies and secrecy to deny them closure. In 2006, the Washington Post reported, quote, "Suspicion of wrongdoing ran so deep that the 10-member commission, in a secret meeting at the end of its tenure in summer 2004, debated referring the matter to the Justice Department for criminal investigation." This was according to several commission sources. "Staff members and some commissioners thought that emails and other evidence provided enough probable cause to believe that the military and aviation officials violated the law by making false statements to Congress and to the commission. My comment. Well, that's really neat. You guys talk about it in secret, and you don't have the guts to do it. Back to the article. What does Farmer's Book tell us? Farmer offers no solutions, only a total and full rejection of what was told, and his own ideas concerning the total failure of honesty on the part of the government, a government with something to hide. Farmer never tells us what they were hiding. Nobody could keep a job in the public sector speaking out more than Farmer has. What were Farmer's omissions? There are some. Now that we know that the intelligence given the 9/11 Commission wasn't just lies from our own government, but based on testimony coerced through torture from informants, forced to back up a cover story, now proven false, a pattern emerges. We know that, immediately after 9/11, many more potential suspects and informants were flown directly to Saudi Arabia by presidential order than were ever detained and questioned. We will never know what they could have said. Their testimony would have been vital to any real investigation were they not put beyond the reach of even Congress and the FBI. Let me interrupt to remind listeners that perhaps even more significant, there were a number of Israelis that were picked up that were also allowed to go back to Israel without really being interrogated. Back to the article. Putting aside all the other questions of recent evidence of CIA involvement with bin Laden prior to 9/11, or altered physical evidence involving the Pentagon attack, any failure to call into account the systematic perjury committed by dozens of top government officials, now exposed as a certainty, is an offense to every American. What do we know? We know the conjectures about 9/11 still stands, but for certain, we know we were lied to. Not in a minor way, but systematically as part of a plot covering up government involvement at nearly every level, perhaps gross negligence, perhaps something with darker intent. Are we willing to live with another lie to go with the Warren Report, Iran-Contra, and so many others? Has the sacrifice of thousands more Americans killed, wounded, or irreparably damaged in a war knowingly built on these same lies from these same liars who misled the 9/11 Commission, pushed us beyond willingness to confront the truth? Have we yet found where the lies have begun and ended? Is there no evidence of this, only evidence to the contrary? The lies live on, and the truth will never be sought. The courage for that task has not been found. Can anyone call themselves an American if they don't demand, even with the last drop of their blood, that the truth be found? How long have we watered the tree of deceit with the blood of patriots? That was Gordon Duff writing in SalemNews.com. Okay, we're about out of time. An article that I won't have time to read. Belgians are protesting a dictatorship established under the pandemic pretext. Evidently, the Belgian government is trying to circumvent their own parliament and their own laws by saying that in the case of swine flu or other pandemic, they can abrogate all of their laws. And the Belgians are up in arms about that. There's an article by Cindy Sheehan, and she's extolling people to go to Washington, D.C. with an organization and protest. Another article, Israeli high schoolers choose jail over occupation army service. And this is that in Israel, after high school, you're required to go into the military, male and female, and there's a lot of Israeli high schoolers that are refusing to serve because they don't like what their army and their government is doing to the Palestinians. And then there's an article on the swine flu vaccine may be more dangerous than the swine flu. It's by a doctor. Again, not time to read that. Okay, nearly out of time. This one's for you tool users. I read off some of it, so some more tools and their explanations. A hammer that's originally employed as a weapon of war, the hammer nowadays is used as a kind of a divining rod to locate the most expensive parts adjacent to the object you're trying to hit. It's also used as a replacement for a screwdriver. A pipe cutter is a tool used to make pipes too short. An oxyacetylene torch is used almost entirely for lighting various flammable objects in your shop on fire. Pliers are used to round off bolt heads, sometimes used in the creation of blood blisters. Vice grips, generally used after pliers to completely round off bolt heads. If nothing else is available, they can also be used to transfer intense welding heat to the palm of your hand. Welding gloves, heavy-duty leather gloves used to prolong the conduction of intense welding heat to the palm of your hand. A 2-ton engine hoist is a tool for testing the maximum tensile strength of everything you forgot to disconnect. A tool for testing the maximum tensile strength of everything that you forgot to disconnect. Wire wheel cleans paint and rust off bolts and then throws them somewhere under the workbench with the speed of light. Also removes fingerprints and hard-earned guitar calluses from fingers in about the time it takes you to say, "Yow!" Okay, there you have it. Rabble Rousing's contribution to your choosing a gift for your tool-using friends.